The inaugural season of Major League Cricket was by many measures a smashing success. We all want to see the league grow to reach its potential, but we also want to make sure our cricketers are taken care of. Here to discuss this and the new USA Cricketers Association is FICA CEO Tom Moffatt. Tom, thanks for joining the pod.
Thanks, Knight. Thanks for having me.
Tom, you played first-class cricket for starters, and then you became a lawyer, and now you're the CEO of FICA. Did you become a lawyer initially with this in mind to help represent cricketers? Was this something that you always had in mind?
Look, it was in the back of my head. And whilst I was playing first-class cricket pretty unsuccessfully here in Australia for a period of time, it was that was during a period of time when I was studying law and training to become a lawyer. And this area was always of interest to me. But really my segue into working for players' associations was at the back end of my career. I had a lot of involvement with the ACA, the Australian Cricketers Association, and saw firsthand the great work that they did on the player welfare and education side and transitioning in and out of the sport for younger players as well. And that really sparked an interest in me that advocating for and supporting players might be something that I'd like to do longer term. And that was really the start of my segue into the Players Association movement.
Now let's talk a little bit about FICA and how it works. So there are a lot of associations underneath this FICA umbrella, correct? Every nation has their own. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so our role is we're effectively the umbrella body and the world players body in cricket. So there are 13 players, countries, players domestically that are affiliated to FICA. So most of the top 17 countries in the world, 13 of those, their player groups are affiliated to FICA. That's generally through their domestic players association. So for example, in Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Scotland, Ireland, Netherlands, and now in the US, the players have got organized and formed an association in their country, and they've all grouped together and affiliated into FICA. And our role really is to advocate for those players collectively at global level. Any of the global issues that impact players, in particular around the ICC tables and anything that's common to all the players around the world, not just in their own country, that's really our role. Along with a key part of our role is also assisting to grow and develop those players' associations and also to help new player groups set up associations, which is obviously part of what we'll talk about with the US Cricketers Association being recently established over there.
Yeah, and these individual nations organizations are very important because every nation has their own labor laws and things like that. So those associations have to be aware of all of that. And I guess that would be a very hard thing to do and to get into the weeds of for FICA on every single issue across the world.
You're absolutely right. And those organizations, the domestic players associations, are absolutely critical to, for example, bargaining terms and conditions with their counterparts in their own countries, which is generally the national governing body or the league in their country. And there's obviously, you know, a lot of intricacies in different parts of the world and different jurisdictions as to what that looks like. So they play a really critical role on the ground in their countries and working closely with and supporting players in their territories. And our role is obviously to support that and to support their work and to help them to grow and develop, but also to pick up the gaps at international level and global level where there's a need for a player voice around the global tables in our sport as well.
And one of those issues, I recently listened to a podcast that you did with Jared Kimber. One of those issues was the player's likeness being used in video games, like in particular, like Cricket 24 from Big Ant. You guys are able to negotiate these types of issues. That's like the international flavor of FICA. That's kind of areas where you guys can step in and protect your players from being exploited or having things done without their permission, right?
Yeah, that's a really good tangible example and quite a recent example for us. We've aggregated the image rights or the name, image, likeness rights of more than 500 of the best players in the world from across those 13 countries. And that's... I think the reality is that wherever our sport is moving, and it's moving more in a global direction, there are more things happening at global level. There are more decisions being made at global level. And then in those examples with video games being produced, you've got people operating, pulling together rights from different parts of the world to make those games good. And we're in the fortunate position to be able to solve that pain point really for some of those organizations who want to come into our sport and invest in the sport we can deliver a real global collective of the best players in the world in that example with their name, image, likeness rights. But more generally, we're just, with our sport in general, we're seeing players move more and more around the world, play in a number of different leagues across different territories around the world, and more and more issues in the game are becoming global issues, which was never probably traditionally the case. Obviously, a lot of the history of the game is a lot of issues have been able to be dealt with at ground level in each country. Now, a lot more issues are becoming global issues and international issues.
Especially with these franchise leagues becoming more and more of a big thing, I'm sure. Obviously, that's going to be the target of something like a video game. They're going to want to feature some of these leagues, the bigger leagues around the world. They're going to want the players' names. And like you said, you solve a pain point for them. And I think you guys definitely realize that a video game is also an advertisement for the players. It's a way to get their names out there. Like FIFA has done such a good job of over the years. But the fact that we see these games happening is a great thing. And it's good to preserve the autonomy of the players. And I think sometimes that gets lost, that you preserve the autonomy of the players collectively. I know there's a lot of arguments against unions in various industries where people will say things like, oh, if we don't have a union, we can negotiate directly one-on-one with you. And I feel like I don't think that's how it works. I feel like more if you're unionized, then they have to negotiate with you. And then they have to meet your needs, or you have a better chance of getting your needs met. If you're on your own, then they can ignore you independently.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And look, if we're in the fortunate position of having a bird's eye view of how players are treated in different parts of the world in our sport. And we also speak to the other sports a lot as well. And we're closely aligned with a lot of the US players associations and the different sports over there through our membership of the World Players Association, which is the umbrella across all sports. And we know, frankly, that players in countries where they're represented collectively by a players association have better terms and conditions, and they're better protected than in countries where there is no players association. That's a pretty straightforward message that we tell players around the world, and that's based on us having a bird's eye view, as you said. So there's no doubt about that. And from our perspective, the players associations around the world, it's clearly protecting players and protecting people is the core focus, but it's also about contributing to the game and making sure that on behalf of players, that the association is able to present their voice and their views and their opinions, and also help to grow the game. Ultimately, no one benefits more from having a successful sport than the players. It's in their interest to have the sport humming and being successful. There's clear alignment there with governing bodies or leagues as well, and this works best when everyone's working in partnership together.
I think our own leagues here in the USA, our own major sports leagues, are proof that a strong players union actually makes the league, the product, stronger. I think a lot of times that can get lost in other priorities otherwise. Like, if you look at it, where are players going to play? They're going to play where they're treated the best. They're going to play where they're paid the best. And you're going to get the best players that way sticking around. There's a reason why the NBA doesn't have a rival around the world. There's no league that really threatens the NBA around the world. There's plenty of great professional basketball leagues around the world, but everyone wants to play in the NBA. Part of that is the players make good money. And part of the reason they make good money is because they're organized. And our professional sports leagues, they make tons and tons of money. And most of the time, about 50% of that is a player's share. And that was not going to happen on its own without collective bargaining. And that's helped preserve the very best players to the league. But with the players benefiting from that and with them aspiring to that, now everybody who plays basketball here when they're 7 years old wants to play in one league. And I think, obviously, in cricket, we have different leagues all around the world. But I think when the players are taken care of, they want to play in those leagues. They want to play where they're going to be taken care of. They don't want to be exploited.
I think it's a great summary that, and where you're sitting in the US, you're really ground zero for the whole players association movement around the world in many ways. And all of those players associations, whether it's NBA, MLBPA, National Hockey League, any of the players associations there, they've all had really strong origin stories, the Curt Flood story in Major League Baseball, and they've evolved into some of the best and strongest players associations in the world that have done a fantastic job for their players and making their sports attractive for the best athletes in your country and from around the world, to your point with NBA as well. But they've also helped the sports as a whole to grow generally and on the economic side. So there's often a bit of a fear factor, I think, when players get organized and start a players association in any sport. And certainly in my experience, when we've helped players from different countries set them up in cricket, that's never really been embraced with open arms from any governing body or league around the world in my time to date. But history tells us that they've absolutely ended up contributing to the success of the sport as a whole. And those leagues over there in the US are some of the most commercially successful sports in the world. And having a players association, a strong advocate for the players, has certainly done no harm in that.
The North American sports leagues, NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, NHL, they're making tons and tons of money. So that 50% is a big chunk. Obviously, if you have an upstart league somewhere, you're going to be paying the players a lot more if you want the league to make a splash. You're going to be. But as the league gets more and more successful, oftentimes in leagues where you don't have good unions, the player's share gets less and less. I think one example, Major League Soccer, the players could be making a lot based on how much the teams are worth. And that would raise the product, I believe. But yeah, they're still far ahead, Major League Soccer, of the IPL, for example, which gives about, I think it's about 8% of its revenue goes to the players, if I'm not mistaken. A massive chunk goes to the BCCI, a massive chunk of that money, just like the ICC revenue share goes to the BCCI. And I think in some situations, I think that opens the door. The fact that players only make 8% of that revenue from the IPL, that could potentially open the door for a rival league to cut in there. And hey, we're going to give our players a bigger share than that. We're the most valuable players in the IPL make about $2 million or so a year. And a lot of people will say, oh yeah, that's $2 million for 2 months of work. Who wouldn't go for that? Everybody would go for that. But the IPL isn't handing back their revenue because it's only 2 months of the year. They're not saying, oh yeah, we're just going to take 1/6 of our revenue because it's only 2 months of the year. They're not doing that. Why should the players approach this as if like it's literally 1/6 of their pay? Like it's not. You make that $2 million in the IPL. You're not going to make $2 million the rest of the year if you're the best player in the world. You're just probably not going to do that collectively for the rest of the year. I feel like they've left the door open for a rival league to actually take over the pole position. Obviously, that sounds outrageous. It sounds completely outrageous to say somebody could topple the IPL. But you pay players better and you put up a good product on the field, you could potentially.
Yeah, look, the IPL has been the pioneer league and it's been fantastic for the sport and it's revolutionized. Sure. So there's no questions around that. But what we are also seeing, to your point, is the growth of the domestic leagues generally around the world and the number of domestic leagues popping up and new ones in the pipeline as well is that they're pretty much year-round opportunities now for players and especially the best players in the world. And we think that ultimately the players are going to gravitate towards the leagues where they're looked after best, where they have the best terms and conditions. Like anyone, any worker in any employment situation, you're going to go to where you feel valued the most and where you're looked after best to be able to support your family and so on and so forth. So as that landscape grows, we think that there will be probably a bit of a normalization of some of the leagues that aren't necessarily looking after the players as well as others. And clearly there'll be a gravitation towards the ones that are. Look, time will tell where that ends up, but that's clearly the direction of travel for the sport is more and more opportunities are coming to the fore in that league's landscape and actually in many ways attracting players away from international cricket towards the leagues as well.
Yeah, David Visa recently, he discussed the franchise bubble bursting to this point here about how there's so many of these things popping up, and he's talked about he doesn't know how some of them sustain themselves financially. It just doesn't look like it's not obvious how they do this. One of the areas where a lot of these leagues seem to make ends meet is at the expense of cricketers. Several cricketers go unpaid or get underpaid. The leagues don't live up to their promises. We see that very often here in the leagues that pop up for a week or two at a time, the tournaments that pop up here. I think this is one thing when people heard about this USA Cricketers Association vote and that it was forming, I think a lot of people thought about it as a union for MLC players because of MLC. But I see it as something that can be leveraged against every league that the players are going to participate in. And I see that it's a way that players can collectively ensure things don't happen like the APL where I believe there are still players that still haven't been paid in that league. And there can be demands made collectively by a group to a league that says, okay, if you want some of our players, you have to put their player fees in escrow or something like that. These little ways that they can ensure that they get paid, that they don't get burned, because we want professional cricketers to exist. We want them to feel like it's worth doing. And part of that is ensuring that they get paid when they're told to get paid. Obviously, there's no security in professional sports. There's very little security in professional sports unless you're absolutely a world beater. But even then, it's difficult. There's no promises. But I see the USA Cricketers Association as something that could be leveraged to get players fair treatment in every league that happens in the USA, and even against the national governing body.
You're absolutely right. And I think being a professional athlete and being a pro cricketer, it really is a short term and a pretty precarious career path. You know, clearly it's a really exciting one, and if you're fortunate enough to get to the top of your sport, there are opportunities there, and it's something that a lot of people would love to do. But that doesn't mean it's necessarily a really secure career path from an employment perspective. And I know we've worked closely with the leadership of the US Cricketers Association and their executive committee to obviously help them get established and set up. And the first push of that, to your point, has been largely focused around MLC, because obviously that's where the bulk of the game has gravitated towards over the last 6-12 months in particular. But I know for a fact that group and the player group are really strong on the USCA ending up as a voice for all pro players in the country, whether that's at national team efforts or whether it's looking at some of the other leagues, to your point as well. And having a central collective voice for all professional players in the country, you know, that's clearly the aim, and that we think would be a great positive for the whole sport over there, because it's going to tidy up some of the issues. There's no doubt about that. And the history tells us that players' associations can play a key role in that. But it'll also help to make cricket an attractive sport for the best athletes in the US as well. And if that's people coming from elsewhere to come and play in the US, or if that's tapping a bit more into the local athlete population, both of those things I would think would be a real positive for the sport over there. We want to see a situation always where if a league is sanctioned and it's up and running and it's a professional sporting league, that the players go there and they've got confidence that they're going to get what's in their contract that they've signed, and they're not going to get burnt. And again, we know we're in a fortunate or an unfortunate position of being able to see a lot of these issues around the world. And some of the stats that we have are pretty galling for the sport, really. Our latest player survey data at global level has around 30% of players in the world have experienced late or non-payment in a league that's been sanctioned by either national governing body in their country or by the ICC. And as a sport, that's not good enough, clearly. And you know, a key part of our role is to make sure that we're helping players when those issues arise, but also trying to proactively get ahead of those issues, because we don't want to just be mopping up after those things. We want to actually have setups that can get ahead of them. We know there are issues in the game. Your point on escrow was a good one, and that's one example of the sort of mechanism that could be in place to make sure that if you're going to a league, the money is there that you've been promised and you're actually going to get paid. But there are a few other mechanisms like minimum contract standards or fit for purpose arbitration bodies that can mean you can get your issue heard really in a really expedited way and in a fit for purpose way. That mean we're not constantly chasing our tails around the world on that issue, for example. So it's a really good point, and I know the USCA guys are going to be working hard to get the association set up to represent and effectively advocate for all players in that space as well.
And we're an associate member nation. We don't have an enormous budget. Even if we're run perfectly well, which we aren't, but even if we were run perfectly well, I would argue that having a strong union it takes that worry off of the national governing body's shoulders. They have their hands full already without chasing down league operators who haven't paid people, for example, without making sure that they're going to pay people, without setting out these rules and guidelines and double checking on everything. And I think if you have a strong union that's doing these things for the players, it will help take some of that burden off of the national governing body.
Absolutely. Where this works best around the world in cricket and in other sports is where the governing body or the league is working closely and collaboratively with the players association on these kind of issues, because clearly it's not a good thing for the sport if you've got a lot of spot fires, and whether it's non-payment issues or health and safety issue, whatever the issue is, the more that the players collectively and the governing body of the league can be on the same page with addressing those issues and having really clear processes and protocols around, and agreed processes around how you're going to deal with those things, the better. And it just makes the sport more attractive. It keeps it out of the news for all the wrong reasons and keeps it in the news for the right reason. That's clearly something that having a players association and a well-established players association can contribute to. And it's another reason why we think more governing bodies and leagues should embrace them as part of the growth and the professionalization of the sport and in their country, as opposed to pushing back, you know, based on potentially a fear that a fear of the unknown, or that players are going to come and take all the revenue in the game, or whatever that may be. Yeah, we're really lucky to have a bird's eye view of how that looks around the world, and it definitely works best when there's a partnership and there's a collaborative working relationship between the two.
In Australia, with the Players Association there, do you feel like there's a good relationship between them and the Australian national governing body?
Without speaking on behalf of the ACA, we work very closely with them, and Todd Greenberg, who's the current CEO over there, has actually also been on the initial executive committee of the US Cricketers Association as well. So he's been pretty close to the setup over there. But look, my understanding is that they're working pretty collaboratively and well at the moment, and it's a genuine partnership, and there's revenue sharing arrangements, and they've got a mature collective bargaining agreement here that's existed for a number of years, you know, and really strong player welfare and development programs that are supported by the governing body and obviously the Players Association in delivering them. I think that's in a pretty good spot at the moment, but that's not to say there haven't been issues historically. And I think you probably just have to Google to find out that there have been some historical tension points, probably between all players associations. But ultimately, that's part of having a robust landscape where people are represented. There's different points of view in the sport as to what's the right thing and what's fair, but you work through those things and you set up processes to work through them and ultimately get an outcome that's better for the whole sport as well.
And we know that there are some nations that haven't unionized, where their cricketers haven't unionized, particularly in South Asia.
Yeah, so the four without players associations of that top 17 countries in the world, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Afghanistan.
That's it. Yes. Now, that's 4 out of 17, as you said. It's pretty good that you've got 13 out of 17 that have come together. Do you believe that those cricketers, especially since many of these cricketers play across different leagues in the same leagues, do you believe that cricketers who aren't unionized right now have benefited from the unionization of the others?
It's a good question. And I think my answer is there's no doubt about that, because I think there's, for instance, with our work at global level, FICA's always historically negotiated player prize money, for example, in ICC events. That's benefited all players, even if you're not necessarily part of the FICA group. That's one really tangible example. And I think what we see around the world is probably a little bit of perceived pressure, even if there is no players association in a country. If there's noise made about a particular issue or what international best practice is in different parts of the world, often that's been implemented on the back of the work of a players association or, you know, our work at global level as well. I think there's definitely been an element of the group of players associations benefiting players more broadly irrespective, but that's no substitute for having a properly set up voice in your country or around your league, because ultimately the needs in different countries and leagues are very specific, often to those countries and leagues, and there's different ways of operating around the world. So we would encourage every player group to consider what best practice is around the world. And we're always open, our door's always open to any conversations that players and agents or whoever else in the landscape may want to have.
The 40-hour work week was brought about long ago by unions making demands. Unions made the demands, businesses gave in, industry gave in. 40-hour work week was born because of unions, because of organization. Now, union workers aren't the only ones that have a 40-hour work week. Everybody basically does now. But it's because of some unionization that everybody benefited. While that's true, union workers, people who are protected by a union, yes, everybody works 40 hours a week, but the union workers still get more benefits than non-union workers, obviously. I look at it like that as far as how unions help the world, but how important it is to join one when you get the opportunity, and how it does protect you I know that I'm a member of a union. I see the benefit of it myself, and I have been for a long time. I definitely see a benefit to it. So that's how I look at it. It's like everyone's going to benefit from unions, but you're going to benefit more if you belong to one.
Yeah, I think that there's no doubt about that. And another tangible example of that with our work is the commercial programs that our players' associations run in their own countries, and that we've now set up at global level, you know, with group licensing and some of the video game space that we talked about earlier. But at their very core, what players' associations are about is providing players with a platform to have a voice and have a say. So obviously, if you don't have a players' association, then you're not going to have a really strong collective voice and a say on the game in your country or in your league. If you strip it right back, that's really what it's all about. And we think that's nothing but positive for players when they do have a voice and a say, and also for the game, as I said.
Great. Now let's talk a little bit about the USA Cricketers Association vote. You mentioned earlier that it came about because of Major League Cricket, because obviously we now have something that's at the top of the heap right now in USA Cricket. Was there any impetus to this? Was there any issue directly that led to this formation or this vote to unionize?
So the genesis of it was we had a number of players come to us as speaker probably 12 or 18 months ago now with quite a few issues that they were dealing with on the ground, with some of the transition onto new contracting models and things like that as the sports evolved and started to professionalize more in the US, and obviously with the establishment of MLC as well. And that was really the catalyst, and those players and the player leaders wanting our guidance and a steer on how best to navigate that and how best to set up an association so the players could have a voice and have a say and get some better protections in place. So that process then took place over the last 12 or 18 months to the point where the vast majority of players in the recent version of the MLC were all members of the USCA. It was formally set up and established in October last year in 2023. And quite a quirk of fate was the very first formal meeting of USCA was actually held in the office of the Major League Baseball Association in New York there, which is quite a cool bit of synergy between the players' associations and some of the history of the movement there as well. But on the back of that, USCA effectively wrote to MLC requesting voluntary recognition for the association, given it was now formally established. MLC denied that, which then put it into a process run by the National Labor Relations Board, whereby the players had effectively a ballot or a vote where they needed to confirm that they were supportive of being represented by the association, by USCA. And that vote was counted last week, and the players, the significant majority of players confirmed what we already knew, which was that they were supportive of the USCA and that it represented them as a player body. So that process has now taken place, and the USCA is now formally set up and recognized. And that obviously triggers some things under US law that mean, in addition to recognition, there's also a requirement for MLC to collectively bargain with the USCA on behalf of players with respect to terms and conditions and contracts, etc., in relation to Major League Cricket. And obviously the plan for the USCA, as we talked about, and I know the leadership is quite strong on this, is to continue to evolve, to be a voice for all players in the game over in the US as well.
Right. Was there a quorum that had to be established by that vote?
Yeah, so it's a simple majority process, and it was an overwhelming landslide majority that ended up voting yes for it. So it was, yeah, legally it just needed to be a simple majority, but it by far exceeded that.
Very good. And players can join now if they want to. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I think there's an executive committee meeting later today where the USCA Exco is meeting to just talk about those last few players who haven't joined up front. That group is really supportive and strong and really wants to make sure that all the players, all the professional players in the US are part of USCA. And that's only going to be a positive, obviously, for the association and for players to make sure they're all together on issues and can help to grow and evolve the association and lead the association, given it exists for them, but also for the sport. It's going to provide a coherent point of reference for whether it's USA Cricket or MLC in the first instance to have a negotiating counterpoint and a port of call on collective player issues in the country.
Right, right. And also, minor league cricket is a major part of cricket in the USA. It's pretty much our domestic product. It's been successful over the last 3 years in terms of the product it's created and in terms of a lot of the goals they've set out to. Every once in a while, you get a team that hasn't paid their players, and this is unfortunate. It hasn't happened nearly as much as you would think it has, to the credit of minor league cricket. I think that they do make that a point to pursue, but it does happen every once in a while, and I'm hopeful that something like this union can be utilized to help ensure that happens even less, to the point where eventually it doesn't happen at all, because minor league cricket is such an important part of the cricket fabric in the USA right now, in the development of infrastructure and the development of players, that the players have to reliably be paid in order to continue to participate in it and to have faith in the league, because we need them to have faith in that league.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And that's whether you're talking about minor league cricket or any of the other leagues around the world. When you're trying to attract the best athletes to your sport and retain them in your sport, you have to look after them properly. And you're in the US, where there's an incredibly competitive market, yeah, in sports for fans, commercial dollars, and athletes as well. And if cricket's positioning itself to be a key future part of that landscape, then it has to set up properly in the first instance to be looking after people who are ultimately delivering the product and are putting on the show. That's where the eyeballs are pointing, and that's going to be a really critical part of setting it up for sustained success over there as well.
I'm actually really happy, but I'm excited about this vote. I'm excited about the organization. We had a situation, like I said, in the APL where the umpires came together and refused to take the field because they weren't paid when they were told they were going to be paid. That was unusual. That doesn't happen here a lot. People just continue to go along with things because they think if they stand up, they're not going to ever get paid oftentimes. You know how that often works.
Absolutely. And it's challenging terrain for people to come together and for players, or you know, umpires in that case, but obviously for us, for players to come together and stick up for themselves, because to the points we talked about earlier, there's often big pushback on that and there's often big opposition to that. And when you're on 1 year contracts or 2 year contracts or even shorter term contracts, you're incredibly vulnerable in a job and a career where it's perceived that it's a really desirable career path. So if it's not you, it'll be someone else. That's an incredibly vulnerable situation to be in. It's not normal compared to most other people's professions and jobs, but it's why we think collective representation is so important. And so, you know, we absolutely commend the players over there and in all the other countries where they've got organized, because that's the way you can protect yourselves, is by sticking together and making sure that you've got a really strong collective environment where players are looking out for each other and have each other's backs off the field. Obviously, go at it hammer and tongs on the field and go after each other. But off the field, having a strong collective is a really important thing. And we're really excited as well. We're really proud to have supported the process and the USCA, the establishment of the USCA and the players getting organized over there. And we're looking forward to seeing where they can take it and them contributing to the sport over there as well.
A lot of times the people at the top making the decisions, they have an awful lot of money. And whether or not they have any bad intentions, whether or not they're greedy beyond belief, all of these things can be debated. And you can talk about the character of people all you want to. The thing is, that's undeniable. When you are somebody at this point and you have an awful lot of security, when you have that much money, you have a ton of security, you can fail so many times without feeling any pain from your failures. And so whether or not you intend to not look at people's points of view, you can't. You simply cannot see that person's point of view. You cannot even imagine what it's like. The idea that there are players making $10,000 in the IPL while there's players making $1 million, that's a massive difference. And you take that $10,000 and you move it here to the USA, and that's nothing. That's nothing. It's, I think oftentimes, even if they have good intentions, I think oftentimes people at the very top of the pyramid, people at the very top of the pecking order, just simply cannot even fathom what someone's needs are and what somebody else's challenges are. If they're not in their shoes, it gets very difficult to do that. It's hard for all of us to do that. It's going to be especially hard when you can fail that many times without feeling pain. Every one of your failures causes other people pain. So I think why unions are so important and the relationship between unions and their employers has to be strong.
It's a really good point. And often the conversations that we have with players around the world, and especially the top players, who are we're really lucky that the top players around the world have been incredibly supportive of their associations and of our work at global level. And a lot of that is on the back of the fact that the best players in the world know that they weren't always the best players in the world, and they started at the bottom of the pile. And a lot of players, myself included, in my career, you don't progress beyond the bottom of the pile. And that's, yeah, look, if you've, to use a US example, like if you've moved your family across the world to set up in the US and you've got a mortgage and a family that you try and take care of, and you're on a really short-term contract, and your future is at the swish of a selector's pen or an administrator's pen, like that's a really vulnerable position to be in. So you definitely, the ethos of the Players Association movement is looking after all players as a collective. That includes the top players, but it also includes, you know, player number 1,000 as well, whether you're on the men's or the women's side. And that's really important to our movement, and the success of our movement has been built on the back of that and putting people first, because ultimately it's a people-based industry, and the success of the industry is very much based around what the players do on field. And as I said before, that's where the eyeballs are pointing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you don't have a product without the cricketers. And the very best in the world that you said, those guys that make $2 million, they have to play against somebody else. They have to be pushed by somebody else. And like you said, they used to be at the bottom of the heap and they had to work their way up. But this, having some security, gives those players that opportunity. They don't bail out if they have some kind of security. If people are looking out for them, and players are looking out for each other, then they can go a little bit longer before they have to end their careers. And sometimes that means you went just long enough to actually make it.
100%. And a lot of that is about minimum standards as well, whether that's minimum wages or minimum terms and conditions, and some of the base protections that sit in contracts or collective bargaining agreements. I think those are really important to all players, whether you're at the top or the bottom. And that's a big part of the role of the associations, is to raise those minimums, to lock them in so players are protected. And the industry is never going to change completely. There's always going to be an element of you're vulnerable to selection and to decisions that are made at a point in time. But as an industry, we can come together and create the best and safest and most protective environment that we possibly can to make it an attractive sport for the best athletes in the world to be part of.
Do you watch a lot of cricket still, or are you just so engrossed in this aspect of it that it gets old to you?
Good question. We do watch quite a bit, and we're lucky enough, a lot of the meetings we have around the world are often at cricket, so we do get a chance to soak it in. And I think it's still quite important for us to feel it and to understand the different environments that players are playing in, and the different countries and stadiums that they're playing in, and the conditions that they're playing in. So we definitely try and keep close to it. And obviously we're very close to players and put a lot of effort into those relationships as well. And often those conversations happen around cricket. But look, having said that, we're obviously heavily involved in the business side of cricket and the back end of the sport as well. So a lot of the day-to-day is not necessarily the super fun stuff on field. It's more of the back end. But yeah, the short answer is we definitely try to get to as much cricket as we possibly can and make sure that we're close to it and still close to what's happening on the field as well.
And of all of our leagues here in the USA, non-cricket related leagues, what's your favorite to watch?
Good question. We've got a board meeting. We had a FIFA board meeting there during the World Cup in the middle of the year, and I think we're all heading out to Yankee Stadium to see one of the baseball games. So look, I think that's probably the most closely related to cricket. But I think I've been lucky enough to see some NBA games live as well. So I'd have to have an each way bet on NBA versus baseball. Very different sports, but I like them both, and I think there's something there for everyone.
So do you watch John Boy at all?
Yeah, I have seen snippets. Very good. Very good.
Great, great. Pay attention to his Ball and Play League that's launching next month. It's a hybrid cricket baseball league that he does in his warehouse. I'm the umpire. Pay attention to that and see if I get hit in the nuts.
Hopefully that doesn't happen, but we'll keep an eye on nevertheless. I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Nate. It's been great to chat. Complete me, I'll come back for you.